We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
Welcome to Who's Counting? This is the podcast about election integrity and about everything about elections, how they should be run, how they are not run properly, and all the things about elections. I'm Cleta Mitchell, the host, and I want to welcome our guest today, who has been with us before, but will probably be back with us over and over again. I've gotten a lot of wonderful comments about Hans's appearance on this podcast previously, and I think you're really going to enjoy and learn a lot from our conversation with Hans today. I'd like to welcome Hans von Spakovsky, who is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Ed Meese Center for Legal Studies. Did I say that right?
You did.
And a former Justice Department lawyer, former chairman of the Federal Election Commission, former chairman of the Fulton County, Georgia Election Board, and many years' experience in the realm of elections, election law, and election process. He's a prolific writer and author of a new book, which we talked about on the previous episode of Who's Counting. And Hans, welcome today, and tell us about your book and how it's doing. What's the title of the book again?
It's called Our Broken Elections, How the Left Changed the Way You Vote. And it's doing very well because it really kind of summarizes what happened last year, all the rule changes that the far left has been trying to put in place for many years. And as you know, they used COVID as an excuse and justification to get many of those changes in place, which they had been unsuccessful in getting. And, you know, that effort has not stopped. You know, we're hearing that they are once again going to try to push bills through Congress to put many of those bad changes permanently in place.
Well, we appreciate all that you've done. It's been a busy year. 2021's been a busy year for Hans von Spakovsky because Yes. you've written a book, you publish all the time, you've been so helpful in fighting off and helping fend off these bad laws in Congress and helping to support some of the good law changes that have been happening in the legislatures. And in addition to all of those things, you have just published in December of 2021 a heritage product that you've been working on, you and your team have been working on all year. So tell us what it is you've just published.
Well, like I said, it's not me. We had the entire legal center working on this. So it was a joint project, a very massive project. In essence, what we decided to do this year was to take a look at the laws of every single state and the laws relevant to the security, fairness, honesty, and integrity of the election process, and to see, do they have laws in place to protect the integrity of the election process? So we had to basically analyze and summarize the laws of all 50 states, plus the District of Columbia. We included D.C. They're not a state, but they do have three electoral college votes, makes them important in the presidential race. And then we came up with a set of criteria, best practices for what we think those laws should be. This was not just developed by Heritage. We brought in outside election law experts. We brought in some election officials to talk to them. And we developed 12 broad criteria, everything from how states clean up and maintain the accuracy of their voter rolls to how they handle absentee ballots. And then within those 12 broad categories, we came up with 47 individual criteria of best practices. And then we compared each state's laws and regulations to the best practices. One thing I think that one of the mistakes, Cleta, that people are making is this is not a performance scorecard. You know, we very prominently say on the first page that the best laws and regulations in the world aren't going to do you any good if election officials are not complying with those laws or not enforcing them. But it's hard to come up with objective criteria to judge that. This is showing what the laws and regulations are. On the other hand, this will give state legislators and folks at the grassroots level the tools to make sure that their local election officials are actually doing what they should be doing, complying with the law.
Well, I think that this is very complicated and very hard to do. It has taken you said it's taken all year.
It took all year to do it,
and a lot of people.
Yes,
a lot of input. So let's start with what are the 12 broad criteria? What are those 12?
Well, I brought a summary of them.
Okay.
Whether they have a voter ID law.
All right. And what would you say about the voter ID law? They need to have photo ID.
It needs to be a photo ID, and it needs to apply to both in-person and absentee balloting. They need to provide a free ID to anyone who doesn't have one, and there needs to be no affidavit exemption. Some states have put in a huge hole in their ID laws by saying, well, if you don't have an ID, you can just sign a form in which you claim that you are who you say you are. So I could go in and claim I'm Cleta Mitchell, and they'd have to let me vote.
So voter ID, that's at the top of the list.
Yes.
Are these in order, by the way? Because you weighted each one of these,
they
right?
have different weights. The 12 categories add up to 100 points.
Okay.
And we weighted all of these different categories with a different amount of points. Again, consulting with a lot of folks to say how important is this to maintaining the security of the election process. I should say no state got 100 points.
Okay, so voter ID is weighted the highest.
Right.
Okay, what's next?
Accuracy of voter registration lists.
So those are the voter rolls.
Yes. Yeah, everything that the states do to make sure that the voter rolls are accurate and that they remain accurate and that they take off people who become ineligible because they've died or moved out of the state or otherwise are no longer eligible to vote.
And that's the one that has the second. Are those weighted the same or?
No, voter ID is 20 points. Accuracy of voter registration list is 30 points. Next is
Wait, 20 points for voter ID, but 30 points for voter lists?
Yes.
So that makes voter rolls the most important.
It does.
Okay. I had that backwards. Yeah. Sorry. All right. Yeah. So.
Well, you know, and look, voter rolls are the.
They're the cornerstone.
They're the cornerstone.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Of voting.
Okay. So number one is the accuracy of the voter rolls. Number two is
voter ID. Absentee ballot management
is number two.
Yeah, we have 21 points for that.
Oh, right.
Because as you know, we've had a huge increase in absentee ballots. Absentee ballots, unfortunately, are the easiest way to steal an election because mm-hmm. they're the only kind of ballots that are cast outside the supervision of election officials, outside the observation of poll watchers. They have to be very careful, and you have to put in all kinds of provisions to try to prevent that from happening.
What would you say when we're talking about if you had to pick one thing that's most important about absentee ballot voting or voting by mail, what would be the one thing you would say, you just have to do this, you have to make sure that this does not happen?
Well, we gave a separate category to, and it awarded 4 points to states not allowing vote trafficking.
Okay.
Vote harvesting. That's
it's that one component of voting outside the purview or the observation of the election offices observers is really given two different categories.
I mean, that's so important. And if folks don't know what that means, vote trafficking, a lot of folks try to refer to it as vote harvesting because that sounds better. States should not allow third-party strangers to go to voters' homes to pick up and deliver their absentee ballots. Yeah, the voter ought to be able to do it. His family ought to be able to do it. Maybe a designated caregiver. But allowing third-party strangers like candidates, campaign staffers, party activists to pick up ballots, you're just asking for trouble because you're putting something valuable into their hands.
It's currency. To me, I always say ballots are like – they're like – remember when we used to have paper airline tickets?
Yes.
And you always knew that ticket, once you got that paper ticket, that was like – money. And if you lost it, that's like losing $300.
Right.
I think we need to think about ballots like that.
No, I think you're right. And if somebody were to find or steal that from you, it used to be they could use that to fly on your fly on your plane. So, right.
But so absent. So ballot harvesting. I will say this about ballot harvesting. So as you pointed out earlier, I thought this is ironic. The hypocrisy of this is stunning to me. So at the very time during COVID in 2020, when the left and the Democrats were getting all these laws changed, filing all these lawsuits saying COVID emergency, people can't go to the polls to vote. It's too dangerous. You can get the COVID. We have to vote at home. But, oh, yes, we're going to allow perfect strangers to come to the door, to come into your house to get your ballot.
And not only that, but to go from door to door to do it. Right, right.
Right, which they did in Philadelphia and other
right.
places.
Anyway. So we have a number of standards or criteria within managing absentee ballots. That's 21 points. But then the next category is states should not allow vote trafficking, vote harvesting.
And
that's four.
That's
four
really points. 25 points.
25 points
those two.
For the handling of absentee ballots.
That's really good.
But like I said, the banning vote harvesting, vote trafficking was so important, we thought it should be its own separate category mm-hmm. aside from the absentee ballot management. Then access of election observers.
Yes.
That is so important. You know, transparency is fundamental to yeah. fair and honest elections.
Absolutely.
That's why the U.S., our State Department, sends teams of observers of Americans all over the world to watch elections in fledgling democracies. And you and I both know, because we all saw it, in last year's election, we had observers being thrown out or being restricted from being able to see what was going on in places like Philadelphia and Detroit.
Georgia,
Fulton County, and elsewhere. And you cannot allow that to happen. So you've got to have very strong laws that give observers access. And look, this is not a partisan issue.
Mm-mm,
we
no.
want observers there from all the political parties, all the candidates, because that's when everybody's watching everybody else like a hawk or an eagle. That's when you're going to try to ensure that bad things don't happen.
I noticed, by the way, that because one of the components, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but one of the components in your model proposed model law is to allow observers from third parties that may not be the candidate, may not be the political parties,
right.
but maybe third parties. And I think there's a lot of interest in that because a lot of people don't trust the political parties,
right.
Both on the right and the left. And it almost seems like they're denied the opportunity to perform this service and keep an eye on both political parties.
Oh, yeah. No, and that's one of the reasons we put that
I like
there.
That. I think a lot of people would really like that. Okay, yeah. But access of election observers. And you mean meaningful access. Number one, not only having the law. I think there are a few states that don't even allow observers at all. Most states do. But there are even a few states that don't allow them at all.
Yeah. Now, the access has to be – they cannot be put 15 feet behind the registration desk, for example, in a polling place where they can't see people's names being checked, people being checked in, making sure, like in a state that requires ID, their ID is being checked. They have to have the same access as the people who work in the polls. Yeah, they can't interfere with the voters. They can't interfere with the process, but they have to be able to see
what's happening.
What is happening. And that's part of our rating, because we think that's very, very, very important.
Well, one of the things I would tell you that I've even though as someone who's been doing this a long time, I would say that I've learned some lessons this year, really after drilling down into what happened in 2020.
Right.
And transparency, in my view, you're 100% right. So many complaints about in the post-election about things that happened in Georgia where they were not allowed. In fact, I love the photo that one woman posted. She took a telescope. Yeah, or she took binoculars and they took a picture of her. These were the observers, and they had binoculars because they put the observers just so far that she took binoculars to demonstrate how far away they were from what was
right.
happening. And then, of course, we saw the video in State Farm Arena where they literally made the observers leave and
right.
then say we're through for the night. And as soon as they left, they started counting again. So
yeah. And the laws not only have to provide full access, but they need provisions in there to discipline and possibly prosecute election officials who don't comply with the law.
Yeah.
You know, the individual election officials in last year's election who improperly threw observers out should have been fired.
Yeah.
They should not have jobs. They should not still be working.
Okay. So access of election observers. How many points did that?
That's 3 points. Because okay. Remember, we got 100 for all of this.
Okay.
Remember, we have a lot on the accuracy of voter registration rolls, 20 points for that. But we thought, again, a separate category ought to be verification of citizenship. Ah. That's so important that while it's part of the accuracy of voter registration rolls process, we gave it a separate category and we gave it 4 points.
Let me ask you a quick question. Senators Lankford and Rubio have introduced a bill let me back up. The city of New York has enacted a system to allow non-citizens to vote. San Francisco has passed a bill to let non-citizens vote, supposedly in their non-federal elections. But Senator Rubio and Senator Lankford have introduced a bill to withhold federal funds, I guess, from jurisdictions and states that allow that. So what do you say about verification of citizenship? You're not just limiting that to federal elections, are you?
No, I think right now every state requires folks to be citizens in statewide elections. It's just in a couple of places around the country, local towns have said, well, we're going to let you vote in local elections. I actually think the New York City Council vote to allow non-citizens to vote in local city elections there is problematic because, as I read the New York State Constitution, mm-hmm. I think it requires citizenship not only for state elections but also for local elections.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this in relationship to this bill that's been introduced by Senators Lankford and Rubio, and that is, as you know, and the campaign finance statute, there's a prohibition in the federal law that says no one who is, if you're not a U.S. citizen or a permanent residence with a foreign national with permanent resident status, you have to be one of those things, citizen or permanent resident with non-citizen status, or non-citizen with permanent resident status. You cannot make a contribution to a candidate. You cannot have any kind of – you can't make an expenditure or a disbursement that relates to any election. And that statute specifically applies to federal, state, local elections. Yes. Why couldn't the federal law apply equally to having those very people that can't make a contribution or expenditure? How can you allow them to vote if they can't make a contribution or expenditure?
Yeah, and that statute's been upheld. You know, normally the federal government can't really set the rules in a lot of areas of state elections, but mm-hmm. that particular law has been upheld because the Supreme Court has said that while people who are not U.S. citizens do have certain rights when they're in the United States, the one area where the government can exclude them is everything having to do with self-government. Mm-hmm. That's why it is perfectly legal, the court has said, for example, for aliens to be excluded from juries, from being police officers, all kinds of things having to do with self-government. The Supreme Court has said, yeah, that can be banned.
So it's not just in the voting arena. It's in others as well.
Yes. Anything having to do the language. In fact, I've been in the middle of just drafting a paper on this issue. And when it comes to all of the elements of self-government and determining how a democratic republic governs itself, aliens can be excluded, and it's perfectly constitutional.
Well, you know, what's interesting, do you remember, I'm sure you remember this, when Citizens United, the decision in Citizens United versus FEC was handed down, and it said that corporations could make independent expenditures.
Right.
And if you'll remember, one of the hysterical cries from the left about how horrible this was that it would somehow invalidate the prohibition on foreign involvement in elections.
Right.
And this statute that we were specifically talking about. When, in fact, the Supreme Court decision specifically said, this does not apply to this other section of law.
Right.
It only applies to the section having to do with corporations and all. And remember that scene when Obama was giving his State of the Union address, and he's making in his State of the Union attacking the Supreme Court, with the Supreme Court sitting there right in front of him, saying this could allow for foreign interference in our elections. And Justice Alito was looking, not shaking his head. The camera caught him shaking his head, saying, "Not, that's not true."
Right.
But I
right.
think it's so interesting that here they are, on the one hand, you know, saying Donald Trump wasn't legitimate because of the Russian involvement or collusion with the campaign, which turned out to be a complete lie. They hated Citizens United because they said, "Oh, this will open the door for foreign money coming into our elections." And now then, here they are making it legal for non-citizens to vote in their city right. elections.
Right, which is a way of devaluing citizenship.
Oh, yes.
You know, and it's really... citizens are the ones who should make the decisions about how we govern ourselves, not aliens.
So you make access of, or you make the whole issue of verification of citizenship is one of your criteria.
Yes. Yeah. Next, we have identification for voter assistance, 3 points. And what we're talking about there is, look, every voter under federal law and state laws too has a right to get assistance when they go into the voting booth if they are disabled, if they don't speak English well, and that's correct. But the problem that we have seen, and I had a federal case like this when I was at the Justice Department, is folks not going in to simply help the person, for example, read the ballot, but going in and saying, "Here's how you need to vote.
Oh, right.
You need to vote for this person. Here, I'll fill out the ballot for you." And the problem is that if a voter later complains, that instead of being given assistance, the person voted their ballot for him or something else, without identifying who was the person assisting them, there's no way to prosecute. Mm-hmm. And so all this requires is that if you go into a polling booth and you need assistance, you're bringing somebody in with you, that person needs to be identified. They need to either fill out a form, or election officials need to note their name, their address, who they are, so that if there are later allegations that they went beyond simply assisting, you can actually do something about it.
Did you think about saying that you shouldn't be able to bring in third parties as the assistants, but to require that be any assistance had to be provided by the election officials themselves?
You can't do that because federal law, part of the Voting Rights Act, requires that all voters have a right to assistance as long as it's not their employer or their union steward.
Oh. Well, that's interesting, because I will tell you that in my experience, I've seen this happen many times, where the worst offenders, and actually this is really a protection to the most vulnerable of our voters.
Exactly right.
But
yes.
I've seen situations where you have a group of people living in a group home. Maybe they're physically disabled, have mental or special needs issues, and you'll have a van show up with someone who runs that group home, and they get out and they bring them in, and whoever runs that group home or somebody, a worker, goes in with each one of them and essentially votes their ballot for them.
Right.
And that's what you're saying, is there has to be a way
to identify who that assistance person is. Right.
And
that's in no way going to interfere
no.
with the voter's ability to get assistance. And anybody who makes that claim is just wrong, because any person providing assistance who's doing it honestly and legitimately,
they wouldn't care.
Why would they care about saying who they are?
Yeah.
They're not.
No.
Only the people who want to do bad things are not going to want to be identified.
That's right. All right. What's another one? How many points did you give that one?
The identification. 3 points.
3 points for identifying the voting assistance person.
Then we have a section on vote counting practices.
Oh,
that's
wow.
3 points.
Oh,
and there's various criteria.
Who's
there.
Counting? Remember, that's the name of your book in 2012, and the name of this podcast and my website.
And I'll just give you an example of one criteria there. One of the criteria is that the voting of ballots should be continuous.
Yes.
It should not suddenly stop so that observers leave and then aren't there. And in essence, what it ought to be is once the voting of ballot starts, it needs to be continuous.
The counting
until it's over, with the only reason being for stopping it is if there's some kind of emergency situation, and that could only happen if the election officials give public notice of what that reason is, what that emergency reason is, and when it's going to resume, so that you don't have something happening in the between time that observers can't see.
Well, you know, I know that in the new Georgia law that was enacted in 2021, there is a specific provision that addresses that one thing, that the voting has to continue, at the tabulation and the counting has to continue
right.
until completed.
Right. And that's exactly what we're grading states on.
Okay.
So
How many points did that get?
That was 3 points also.
Okay.
Next was election litigation procedures.
Oh, good.
3 points. And what we're talking about there, something you're very familiar with, is something that happened in last year's election was, you know, what you call collusive lawsuits, mm-hmm. where some particularly liberal group would sue because they didn't like, for example, that a state required a signature comparison mm-hmm. of absentee
Stacey
ballots.
Stacey Abrams filed that very lawsuit
right.
in Georgia.
Right. And you have an election official, sometimes perhaps of the same political party, say,
or sometimes, like in the case of Brad Raffensperger, Republican Secretary of State of Georgia, who signed on with Stacey Abrams because he was afraid he would get bad press and he wanted to endear himself to the media.
Yeah. But whatever the reason is, no executive branch official, including an election official, should be able to agree to waive an election law that was put in place by the state legislature
right.
and signed by the governor.
That's right.
They don't, executive branch officials don't have they don't make the laws. They're supposed to enforce them. They don't have the ability to say, oh, we're just not going to comply with that law. And so not only that, but every voter in a state has a right to make sure that election officials are also complying with the law
mm-hmm.
and not waiving them. So we believe that every state should have either a statutory or a constitutional provision that says no state election law can be waived or changed in a lawsuit without the agreement of the state legislature. So they're a necessary party for litigators and lawyers. Also that ordinary citizens should have standing to sue
to
enforce the law.
Right.
So if an election official says, you know what, I'm just not going to enforce the ID requirement, an ordinary citizen ought to be able to go to court because that can affect the outcome mm-hmm. of the election. Mm-hmm. It can affect their vote, and go to a court and say, judge, we want an order from you telling election official he has to comply with the law or else.
I can't tell you how many. Let me give you a couple of examples of both of these things. In North Carolina, I think this was probably the most egregious example of one of these collusive lawsuits that happened in 2020. And that is saying a lot because there were
many
situations. But in North Carolina, a left-wing group sued the North Carolina Election Board, which is, of course, defended. It's the majority. It's because the governor is a Democrat, then the North Carolina Election Board is majority Democrat. And the state attorney general is a Democrat. And so left-wing group files suit. And I don't even remember now all the things they were challenging. They were basically challenging everything in the law
right.
that would have protected the integrity of the election. Federal judge rules in August. He denies some of the things that they were asking for and sent some of it back to be for further consideration and the report back to the court. So essentially, this lawsuit was under the supervision of the federal judge who had already ruled against the left-wing litigant plaintiffs in the case
right.
On some of their counts. And in September, the Democrat-controlled state election board, and unfortunately, the hapless Republican members, it happens way too often, went along, and because the attorney general came to them and said, you need to agree with this, and he's their lawyer, and they basically entered into a settlement with the plaintiffs and even agreed with the plaintiffs to give the plaintiffs some things that the things that they had asked for that the judge had denied.
Right.
So they enter into this agreement. The Republicans go back to the judge and say, Your Honor, they've just basically agreed to disagree with you and given the plaintiffs by agreement what you've said they're not entitled to. And the judge said, well, yeah, this really makes me mad, but it's too close to the election to do anything about it. So that's these collusive lawsuits. That is a big problem. That is a big problem in North Carolina for sure. I think one of the things that happens far too often, you mentioned having standing to bring suit to enforce the law, that was something that was so important and did not happen, does not happen. And yet every left-wing group that wants to come in and say, oh, this statute that the legislature's enacted violates my constitutional rights, and they always have standing. So why shouldn't citizens to enforce the law have as much opportunity to go to court as the left-wing groups who come in and want to simply eradicate the law that the legislature
passed? Well, they should.
And that's what you're saying.
And that's what we're saying. Okay. And we're grading states on whether they give the legislature and citizens the opportunity to do that.
How many points do you give for that?
3 points.
Okay.
Then we gave, look, there. We've been talking about things that states should have, but there are things that states should not have.
Okay.
And two of the things that states should not have are same-day voter registration and automatic voter registration. Now, you and I have talked about this before, but look, the problem with same-day voter registration is that if you're allowed to go into a polling place, register, and immediately vote, election officials have no opportunity whatsoever to check or verify any of the information on your form.
And particularly if you don't have to prevent any kind of – you don't have to present an ID.
Yes.
So you just show up. You don't have to prove who you are. Right. You can register. You can vote. And you can basically, if you live someplace where there are several states are close by, you can – like, let's say you could go do that in Massachusetts. You could do it – right next door in New York, or what you can do it anywhere.
Right. Plus, it just from a practical standpoint, it actually could lead to disenfranchisement of voters. Why? Because, look, when election officials are trying to determine how many paper ballots, for example, should be in a polling place, they base it on the number of registered voters. If you have 1,000 registered voters and you provide 1,100 ballots, then in case some people have to, mess it up and need one, you're going to be fine. But if at a polling place that has 1,000 registered voters on election day, suddenly 500 people show up to same day register and vote, there may not be enough ballots for them.
That's
so people
right.
may be disenfranchised. But the other bad thing that states are putting in is automatic voter registration, which is when they don't ask you, would you like to get registered to vote when you apply for welfare or you go to get a driver's license.
Or a hunting license. Or a fishing license.
They just automatically register you. And not only does that lead to the registration of people multiple times, it's going to lead to the registration, for example, of people who aren't eligible to vote, like non-citizens. Or if you're a property owner in more than one state, you may end up getting registered in more than one state. Bad idea. So if states don't have either same-day voter registration or don't have automatic voter registration, we gave them credit for that.
Okay. How many points?
3 points each.
3 points each?
Yes.
Okay. That's good.
And then the final category worth 3 points was something that, we saw for the first time last year when all of a sudden Mark Zuckerberg and several other liberal donors contributed – $450 million.
Half a billion.
And they gave them in grants to election officials and election offices. The vast majority of the money going to big urban districts, democratically controlled districts. In essence, what the Democrats did is they moved their Get Out the Vote campaign into official government offices. And having election officials receiving private funding raises all kinds of conflicts of interest and other problems, and so states need to ban any private funding going to election offices and election officials. I don't care whether it's a liberal group or a conservative group, or a liberal donor or a conservative donor. Right. There should be no private funding going to election officials.
Well, I just have been trying to fathom how the left and the media would have responded if, say, Charles Koch had given $500 million to election offices to enhance turnout of Republicans. Their heads would have exploded. Right. And yet they just think it's perfectly wonderful that Mark Zuckerberg and his wife gave $500 million. Yeah, and they're still doing it.
Yeah, and it created unequal voting opportunities.
That's right.
In different parts of states. So there's a lot of problems with it. And so if a state has banned private funding, we gave them 3 points.
You know, one of the things that, you know, Georgia comes out on top in terms of its change laws. We'll talk about the rankings and the index in just a moment. But one of the things they did is they said that the money could go to the Secretary of State, private money. Well, you know what? That doesn't cut it, as far as I'm concerned. There should just not be any private money going into these election offices.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So.
You know, one of the things that is clear to me from all of this is that what you've provided is a framework for what the laws should say. You've yes. identified key topics and key subject matter areas, and the legislatures now have a guide as right. to what their laws say and what they should say and how they relate to what other states are doing.
It's an interactive website. You can pull up one state. It'll give you the details on all of these 47 criteria, and then you can compare it to another state to see where it is. Like I said, keep in mind that no state scored 100.
So talk to us about the scores. Talk to us about the scores.
Well, look, the top states were Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee, but Georgia only had a score of 83, which if one of my kids was bringing home their report card, it would be a B-, and I'd be upset about it.
Right.
Which indicates they still have a lot of room for improvement. Virginia, which is the state where I'm registered in voting, they're like 15th in the country, but they scored a 67, which is either a D or a failing grade.
Yeah.
So no one should be happy that they are or think that because they're towards the top of the ranking that everything's perfect, because it's not. It's clear that all of these states can still do a lot of improvement. On the other hand, we have the worst states in the country, places like Hawaii, Nevada, and California, who that would have to change almost their entire election system to try to bring back fair and honest elections.
You know, I think it's really important for people to look at this, look at your state, look at the rankings, because I think it is telling. I know that some activists have gotten upset that Georgia is number one because they experienced the horribleness of the Georgia experience of 2020.
Right.
But what you've done here is you've recognized these are the statutes on the books today. The Georgia
yes.
legislature actually made significant changes in the law, in their law, in 2021. So much so that the left-wing Biden Democrat Justice Department has sued Georgia.
Right.
And Major League Baseball moved the All-Star game because of the new law. I mean, so people who get mad because this says Georgia's at the top of the heap in terms of the statutes as they stand now, need to understand that Georgia paid a price. Its legislature
right.
paid a price for, or the citizens of City of Atlanta certainly paid a price because the legislature enacted these reforms. I'm glad they enacted these reforms.
Yeah. And their score would have been a lot lower if they hadn't.
If they had not.
Right.
That's
and,
right.
And two things for folks to remember. Look, we're releasing this report in December of 2021, not December of 2020.
That's right.
So this reflects the current laws in every state. Now, what this doesn't reflect is actual performance.
Compliance with the law.
Right. You know, we've got a big warning right at the beginning of the index saying that the best laws and regulations in the world aren't any good if officials don't actually comply with them or enforce them. But it's difficult. I mean, we couldn't figure out a way to come up with an objective measure of that.
I think that's impossible because
yeah.
that there's nothing objective about that because
right.
That's subjective disregard or failure of election officials to comply with the law. And honestly, Hans, when I was working with the team on behalf of President Trump after the November election last year in 2020. One of the things that became starkly apparent to me, and I remember actually, I couldn't sleep, and I finally just got up and went to my office in my house the morning after Thanksgiving, because we had been working on identifying all the problems, and it was like 3 a.m, so it was still dark outside. So I'm looking out into the dark, and I just remember thinking, you know, what are the principles that we should follow for purposes of bringing an election contest?
Right.
And I thought, zero tolerance. Zero tolerance for illegal votes. If the law says that a vote to be legal has to be cast by a voter who lives at his principal residence, then if we have evidence that there are people who were registered to vote at a post office box or a right. commercial building or at a vacant lot, well, that's not their principal residence. So yeah. anybody who's registered to vote at one of those addresses, then that those are all illegal votes. If the law says this and they were able to cast and count a ballot as legal, even though it was a violation of the law, that's, to my view, an illegal vote.
Yeah, but yeah, it is.
if the officials are not enforcing and upholding the law, and I think that that is one of the things that is most disturbing to a lot of people, is all these election officials saying, they look at a provision of the law and they go, well, we don't really think that's a big deal. Well, the legislature made a decision.
Yes. Those election officials like that need to be disciplined and terminated. They should not continue in their jobs because they have an absolute duty to comply with the election laws and regulations that have been set by the legislature and state election officials. And you shouldn't be in that job if you're not going to do that.
Well, I know that one of the things that happened, that the findings in the Arizona audit, and I noticed that in your, you have drawn attention to this in your model legislation, but in the Arizona audit, the Arizona law says that when you mail in a ballot, you have to sign your name, have a right. signature on the return envelope. And they found in the audit thousands of ballots that had come back because they had access to the envelopes that had no signature. And the ballots were taken out and counted.
Right.
And you say in model legislation, what do you say about that?
Yeah, that if there's no signature, it shouldn't be counted.
And you say don't even open it.
Yeah, don't
just
even
discard
open it.
That, yeah. You know, put it in a pile, but it should not be opened. And in Arizona, those right. were opened and counted.
Right. And for folks who say, oh, well, you know, you can't use that to overturn an election because you don't know who they voted for. Sorry, that's the wrong attitude.
Matter. Yeah.
If you know that a vote margin was 1,000 votes and you know that 1,500 people who weren't actually eligible to vote, say maybe they actually lived out of state, voted, the fact that you don't know which candidate they voted for is irrelevant. The illegal votes were larger than the margin of victory, and that should be sufficient. And with a lot of courts, that is sufficient to overturn an election.
And what they do is, what do they normally? You talked about this in your book. You and John wrote about this in your book, about the remedies. In some cases, the courts have said, well, it's not right to punish a candidate who didn't violate the law. But in a case like what we're talking about, you have no way of knowing
exactly
who they voted for.
No. And in a case like that, there's nothing you could do but hold a new election.
And that's what the statute in Georgia says. If there are more illegal votes included in the certified total than the margin of difference between two candidates, then the remedy is a new election. And
right.
Georgia was going to have another statewide election in January of 2021.
Right.
But we just never got a judge appointed. But I think that that's really important, this idea of, well, we just, these poor people who disregard the law, bless their hearts, we just need to let them vote anyway. I mean, what's the point of having an election law?
Yeah, no, and you can't do that. You have to set what the rules are prior to the election. You don't change them at the last moment. And then you've got to adhere to those rules.
So what is your hope? Tell people how they can use this. What is your hope that they'll do with this? What's next? What's phase two for 2022? Since you spent an entire year developing this, and it is—I mean, this is not easy.
Well, first of all, this is not a static scorecard. Okay, as states change their laws, and we have new legislative sessions going to be starting in January. A lot of states in 2022. As states change their laws, we're going to change their ratings. And if states put in bad laws, their score will go down. And if they put in better laws, their scores will go up. What we're hoping is that legislators will be able to use this to see, well, how's my state doing? What needs to be fixed? What needs to be changed? We're hoping ordinary citizens, folks at the grassroots level, will be able to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. They can look and see how their state compares, what needs to be changed. And look, some of the criteria that we have, they don't need legislative changes. These are things that election officials can just start doing. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that at the grassroots level, folks will start paying attention to what their county election boards are doing and start asking them questions the same way that parents have started showing up at school board meetings to complain about the CRT propaganda being fed to their kids. They need to start showing up and finding out, well, county election officials, are you doing basic things like getting jury information so that if somebody's excused from jury duty because they're not a U.S. citizen, are you checking, oh, is he a registered voter? Mm-hmm. So you can take them off the registered voter list? If they're not doing just basic things like that, they're not doing their jobs.
Well, and you know, we talk about getting the Social Security death information in the county offices, but the truth of the matter is you have every state health department or the Bureau of Vital Statistics has death, and they have the deaths. That information should come over every week, every month to every election office. And, you know, it goes right with, I know how important it is what you've done and how this is a tool that every citizen can use. And if you don't mind, I'd like to put it as a resource at www.whoscounting.us to go right there with the Citizen's Guide to Building an Election Integrity Infrastructure. If you had 10 people in a county who took the guide that we have published and then take your criteria and then look at the state where they live, what are the things that can be that they're not doing that they should do legislatively? What are the things that could be done at the local level? We have to recognize something that I have recognized in 2021 that I don't know why I never focused on this, because I've studied the left and fought with the left all these years. But the left has taken over everything in our country, from the school boards, academia, Hollywood, the media, big companies, woke corporations. Should it surprise us that they have infiltrated, they have spent the last decade infiltrating our election systems, every election office in America? Now we have the tools. Now we have the knowledge, the know-how. If you'll read what you've written and all the things you've written, I should just have a link to Hans von Spakovsky to just go directly there. And to read the Citizen's Guide and to say, just what you said, we've got to do what parents are doing in the school boards and knowing what's going on in their schools, and we've got to get off our couches. We've got to go to the election offices. We've got to start watching. And I think that's why Merrick Garland and the left-wing Department of Justice remember, before they issued the warning about calling parents at school boards domestic terrorists, they'd already done that. They'd already said that about people and citizens showing up in election offices.
Yes.
They don't want us there.
No, they don't. And that's why they're threatening people over that, which is just another sign of how unfortunately partisan the Justice Department is under Merrick Garland.
Yeah, it's really terrible. And I hate to say this, but the FBI has become a partisan tool. It has been weaponized for the left. It's hard for me to fathom that has happened, but it certainly seems to have happened in a lot of ways. But I cannot say enough thank yous to you and to your team for all you've done on this. It's a great, great interactive tool. I want to point out something that you and I talked about earlier and have people look. If you look at the top 10 states and the and the bottom 10 states. Is there some kind of pattern that you see, Hans?
Well, the top 10 states seem to be mostly in the SEC football conference.
and the worst ones?
The worst ones tend to be blue states. So.
And you know, that's the thing that I want people to understand. These election laws, these election codes, they are not separate from the policy outcomes that the progressive wacko left want to achieve in our country. That's why the left has focused so much and invested so much money, hundreds of millions, maybe over $1 billion. I'm sure it's over $1 billion, in creating entities that do business with election offices, that get people in the election offices. They understand if they can control the election process, they will control the policy outcomes. So you have California on the list. You see what they have completely adopted, the laws that that the left and the Democrats in Congress want to impose on every state.
Right.
If you want to see how the how HR1 would work in America, just look at California.
Yes. Yeah, they want to Californiaize the rest of the country.
And make it impossible for conservatives to win. I don't think that's too hyperbolic a statement. They want to fix it where can a conservative win in California statewide? Can a conservative win in Washington state statewide? New York statewide? Very, very difficult. Very difficult because of the way the election laws are written. And then that changes the policy outcomes. Taxes, you know, every regulation, whether they're going to cram this CRT down our kids' throats, you name it. So what you're doing is you have unveiled all of this. You pulled the curtain back so everybody can see it.
Well, like I said, it was a lot of work. A lot of people at Heritage worked on this, and folks on the outside, all kinds of experts that we consulted on this. So.
Well, if people have questions or comments, is there a place where people can contact the Mies Center? And
yeah, they should contact me. I'm happy to hear about feedback on this. And actually, like I said, it's a work in progress. So any suggestions folks have on improving it, they should let me know.
Well, the name is the Heritage Foundation Election Integrity Scorecard. And I think that maybe I've been saying that you should change the name to Election Code Scorecard, because in order to have integrity, you have to have the laws that are right, and then you have to have the people follow them. And
right.
Following them and making sure they're enforced, I think that's our job as citizens.
Yes,
to make sure our officials are doing what the law says. So I just thank you so much, Hans, for all you do. And we're going to help you every way we can help get this out. Got to make sure that everybody buys your book because that's a wonderful book. Our Broken Elections. Our Broken Elections by Hans von Spakovsky and John Fund. And with that, I will conclude this episode of Who's Counting. Be sure and share this episode. Subscribe to Who's Counting. Visit our website, whoscounting.us, and join us again for another episode of Who's Counting coming up. But for now, thank you, Hans. We so appreciate your being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kalita.
Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, become part of the Election Integrity Network.